Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Erica Jong, whose latest novel is Sappho's Leap. Her most famous work is Fear of Flying, which created a term that was used for many years, the zipless.
Yes, well, the New York Times just said fastener-free fornication in an essay reappraising Fear of Flying. So they had to say fastener-free fornication. I thought that was clever. So we can use that.
We can use that. Fastener-free fornication. Erica Jong has written several other works, including Fanny, Shylock's Daughter, also has very strong political opinions. But let's first talk a little about Sappho's Leap. When you were thinking about the creation of this, which takes the form of a female odyssey,
right.
And that's odyssey as in Homer's odyssey, were you always intending to have it be fantasy rather than just merely historical fiction? Was that always there, or did that creep in as you worked on the book?
Well, it crept in, but it's intrinsic to the book. I mean, if you're going to go back to archaic Greece, which is really still the Homeric period, because Sappho comes about 200 years after Homer, she's very early. She's way before Plato. I mean, and a different civilization. She's in Lesbos. She's in the Eastern Aegean, 2 kilometers from the coast of Turkey. Mm. Lesbos was a meeting place between East and West
right. In
her time. If you're going to go back to that Homeric world, you have to have a trip to the underworld. You have to have gods and goddesses and centaurs and sirens, and because that's the language in which they spoke. So I knew, you know, I didn't liberate myself into somewhere into the book, but when I figured out that Sappho's Leap was a parody of the story of Odysseus in the Odyssey, I said, okay, you know, if we're in the Odyssey, we've got it. The hero has to go to the underworld. The hero has to meet sirens. The hero has to meet centaurs, Amazons. This is the form. And that was some of the delight of doing it, by the way. Because when I was a kid growing up, I loved the Greek myths. I adored them. And I thought, this book was my homage to the kid who loved Greek myths, in a way.
Sappho's Leap, there are characters in it who are real, in particular Aesop.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, we have no record if Aesop and Sappho ever met, but they were contemporaneous, correct?
Right, they were contemporaries.
Okay.
And Aesop was a slave, and he was a slave of a Greek named Yadmon, and he was a slave in the same household as Rhodopis, who Sappho's brother fell madly in love with and squandered his inheritance on. And this we know from Herodotus' history.
So Rhodopis is real as well.
Yes.
And
they were all contemporary with Sappho.
And were they in Egypt as well?
Rhodopis was in Egypt, in this beautiful city called Naucratis, where the Greek traders went and where they could worship their own gods. But it was in Egypt. But they were allowed to have Greek temples. There was a lively trade between Egypt and Greece in that period.
And Alcaeus, her lover, is he real?
He's real. He was a warrior. He was a singer. Many of the songs that he left behind, fragments, like Sappho's, are still read, and they're beautiful. And actually, he wrote in the same meter as Sappho, which is now called Sapphic meter, and the attributions are sometimes confused. Sometimes it will say on the attribution, Sappho or Alcaeus. So their work has been mixed up. There's always been the theory that either he was her teacher or her lover or her mentor or something.
Was he also political, or is that just...
No, that's absolutely true. Sappho and Alcaeus, we think, rebelled against the tyrant Pittacus and were exiled from Lesbos. And Pittacus was sort of the George Bush of his time. He's always keeping his people at war, because he understands, as tyrants always understand, that the best way to win the hearts of the populace is to keep your people always at war and wave flags a lot. Nothing is new under the sun. The Greeks discovered everything.
Well, I keep thinking that the Bush administration, just as an aside here, instead of reading Orwell's 1984 as a cautionary tale, they kind of read it as a blueprint.
Exactly. They do read it as a blueprint. They're very good at propaganda. Wow, are they good at propaganda. And they're also very good at brazening it out.
Well, let's talk a little about the satirical elements and bring mm-hmm. it together here in Sappho's Leap. What about the relationship of men and women and feminism?
You know, the Greeks had very interesting views about men and women. When you married in Greece, you were about 14 or 15, if you were an aristocratic girl like Sappho, and your husband would say during the wedding ceremony, I take this woman for the plowing of legitimate children. Marriage was about dynasty. Marriage was about making an arrangement that was good for business. You could merge your vineyards or olive groves with the olive groves or vineyards of your spouse's family. It was not considered to be about love, although I'm sure there were people who loved their spouses, as in every age there are. And people were totally open about bisexuality. Men had relationships, tender relationships with other men, often who were their protégés. Women had tender relationships with other women, often who were their protégés. They believed in pleasure. This was a pagan world. It was before Judeo-Christian morality claimed that women were evil and Eve had brought death into the world. And so it was a world that approved of pleasure. In the Eastern Aegean, in Sappho's time, women were far more liberated than they were later in Plato's time in Athens. Women were far more able to participate in symposia. Again, as we see today, male and female sexual politics went backwards in Plato's day. Women had been liberated and they became less liberated in Athens. So one of the things that's alluring about Sappho's Lesbos was it was a time there were strong women, women singers. And all of that was taken back. And I think what interests me is the way through the centuries feminism has pushed forward and pulled back.
Are we in a pullback period now, or is it just some kind of strange interregnum because of the fundamentalist regime in Washington?
We're in a pullback, a deep pullback. I mean, our kids' generation is more conservative than their parents. And that manifests itself in many ways. You know, you read the article in the New York Times about how kids in their 20s trust the military more than their parents did. They're more sexually conservative because their parents, who believed in free love and open marriage, got divorced so many times. And kids in my daughter's generation don't want to get divorced. And they've had sexual freedom since their teens. And so they want to have marriages that endure. Whether they will achieve that or not, we don't know. But that's their wish. And it's totally understandable that parents of the 60s and 70s should produce children of the naught-naughts who are more conservative. I find it totally predictable.
And you have a sample of that in your book with Cleis, the daughter of Sappho, who's far more conservative than her mother.
Right. I think this has been happening throughout history with mothers and daughters and fathers and sons.
Well, you've also written a book on mothers and daughters, so you focused in there. I assume some of that comes in Sappho's Leap as well.
There's a lot of mother-daughter stuff, and Sappho's daughter is critical of her mother's eroticism. And I had a lot of fun tweaking that.
And Sappho herself is critical of the fact that her mother tried to protect her by making her life worse.
Right, exactly.
By marrying her off.
But Sappho was a political exile, and that we hear from many sources, Greek sources. I mean, Herodotus comes later, but we know from Herodotus and other ancient texts that she may well have been a political radical, and she was exiled to Syracuse. So those are facts or factoids on which I've pinned my story, but there's a lot of stuff about her that's not known.
Two areas I want to get into. One is the poetry in the book. There's a lot of poetry. Is that all Erica Jong? Is some of it Sappho? Which is which?
The fragments of Sappho are Sappho's fragments as translated by me with the help of a Greek scholar.
So that's when you have her just sitting there thinking something up, or when you're talking about at the beginning of each chapter?
They're all attributed. I mean, I'll give you an example of Sappho that comes in the book. Age seizes my skin and turns my hair from black to white. My legs no longer carry me lightly, nimbly, dancing like young fawns. What can I do? I am not eternal, though my songs may be. Can pink-armed dawn, who could not save her love, erase these harbingers of age? My youth is gone. Still, I adore the sun. That's Sappho. That's a fragment of Sappho, reworked by me with a Greek scholar. He helped me get a literal translation. I transformed that into English poetry or American poetry, and then he checked it to make sure it was not desperately astray from the Greek. So that is actually Sappho. You'll also find at the end of the book 9 poems that are my poems, which led me into the novel. And there are a couple of pseudo-Sapphic texts. You'll have to figure them out. But most of them are Sappho.
You also teach literature. And one of the most important elements of writing a book is what's called voice, something I'm not 100% clear of. And when I ask everyone, they give me different answers. So I'm not going to ask you to define it. But in terms of this, you're creating the voice of a 2,600-year-old woman.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to
remain. And in English when she spoke Aeolic Greek, which, by the way, nobody speaks anymore, not even Greeks. So it's a tricky thing. I mean, we have to acknowledge that the historical novel is in a way, an artifice.
Right.
We have ancient Greeks speaking English, but that's the artifice of the historical novel. Shakespeare did that when he wrote
Julius Caesar.
And he had these ancient Romans speaking Elizabethan English. That just goes with the territory. So let's just acknowledge that that's an artifice. But within that artifice, you have to find a voice that sounds to you like it might be the voice of an ancient poet, ancient singer. Here's where my love for the Greek myths came in when I was a child. There is a voice in those Greek myths, as translated by Edith Hamilton or whomever, Robert Graves or whomever, that has a kind of purity and simplicity and innocence. And it was that voice I was trying to get. Unless I could get that voice, I couldn't write the book.
That voice is not cynical. That voice is pretty pure. Yet, for the modern audience, we need a little bit of cynicism. We need a little bit of snideness. How do you manipulate it to get that? Or is that just something that happens on an unconscious level, do you think?
Well, in Sappho's Leap, it's the gods who introduce cynicism.
Okay.
You know, Aphrodite and Zeus are arguing
that conversation, yeah.
On a cloud, and Zeus says to his daughter Aphrodite, a woman singer, yes, she might be as great as any man, but she'll throw it all away because of, she'll fall madly in love with somebody totally unworthy. And Aphrodite says, no, she won't, I bet you. And the whole book is a bet between Sappho's tutelary goddess, Aphrodite, and Zeus, the king of the gods, who is a male chauvinist pig, who loves nothing more than to transform himself into a swan or a bull and impregnate mortal women.
Sounds like you had a lot of fun writing those little segments, too.
Oh, did I have fun writing this book. I mean, it was a tremendous research effort
Sure.
to sort of delve into ancient Greece and so on, but I did have a lot of fun.
There's a huge segment, Erica Jong, a huge segment that takes place in the land of the Amazons. And I kept thinking as I was reading that, because it comes up in the context that, okay, we have this male-dominated society, and it was a feminist myth, maybe not a myth, but it seems to be a myth, that somehow if the women were to take over, the world would be that much better a place. And yet the Amazon world isn't. And I keep thinking about people like Margaret Thatcher.
You know, during the second wave of the feminist movement, women would go around worthily saying, if women ruled the world, there would be no cruelty, there'd be no war, there'd be no guns, blah, 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 blah. And yet, I've observed women when they get political power. Margaret Thatcher is one example. Ilse Koch is another. They are not that nice to each other.
No.
And they're often very rotten to other women. So I thought, what if I send up the myth of the Amazons? What if I have them wanting to be pure and loving and kind, but in effect not succeeding, so that Praxinoa, Sappho's slave and lover, believes in the myth of the Amazons, and she allows a breast to be taken off so she can become an Amazon. Then what does she discover? The queen of the Amazons, Antiope, is rather cruel and abuses her people. So I really want to show the complexity of these myths. And in a way, it's my way of saying human beings can be cruel to each other, whether male or female. And I truly believe the wisdom of the Torah, which says kindness is the highest wisdom. And I think that women as well as men have to learn kindness. We're not all born knowing it. Little girls can be very catty to each other. Women can be rotten to each other. We all have to learn empathy. And it's not enough to say women are better, women are less violent. It's true, women don't have testosterone. Little girls don't usually love to play with guns the way little boys do. But we all have to learn empathy. And we're not born knowing how to be kind.
You're listening to an interview with Erica Jong, whose latest novel is Sappho's Leap. When you say we have to be kind, how does that fit into, and there's a big debate going on in the left now, is how do you counter the Republican juggernaut of nastiness, mm-hmm. absolute meanness? Mm-hmm. How do you counter that? If you're kind, they walk all over you. What do you do? How do you fight
back? Well, one of the tragedies of the left in America, for me, has always been the way we fight among ourselves. And also the way we are so uncertain of our positions. I mean, that, I think, is the tragedy of the left, that people will come out and say, you're not left enough, or Noam Chomsky is a bad guy because, you see, he wrote this and he wrote that, or we nitpick each other. And one of the strengths of the right is that they're sure they're right. They're sure they're on God's side. Of course, we're too self-critical to do that, which is one of the great things about the left, that we can be self-critical. But in order to win back political power, we're going to have to do what is the hardest thing for us, which is to unite, which means that we have to stop attacking our own, which means that we have to, in American politics, sadly, it is the center that wins the day. And although you can be critical of Bill Clinton for moving toward the center, it enabled him to be a two-term president and to do many, many good things for women, for example, and to do many, many good things in his executive orders. He did bad things too, but it enabled him to be a two-term president. If he had listened to the screeching of the left, he probably wouldn't have been a two-term president. So I think we have to recognize the political pragmatism, and this is very hard for the left, to be pragmatic. It's hard for us to be pragmatic.
The other side of it is that each individual group has their little individual thing that they're going to push over everything else. When you mm-hmm. go to a demonstration against the war, you see hundreds of signs about other things. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to me that it dilutes it all.
It's very self-destructive. I mean, I remember back in the 70s when I was a teacher at CCNY in New York, I remember during the time of the Kent State Massacre, the students would come forward. I was lying down on Amsterdam Avenue with my students protesting Kent State. And then we would go and march on the president's office of the university. And some people would say, end the war in Vietnam. And other people would say, protest Kent State. And I remember thinking, but the president of the university can't end the war in Vietnam. He doesn't have that power. Yes, he can create need-blind admissions. Yes, there are things he can do, but we can't be unrealistic about what he can do and what he can't do. And that's where I think the left always falls down, in a kind of unrealism, a lack of realism.
The right did it as well, but then they decided not to. And it was that's when, I guess, during the Reagan years, I think Eric Alterman points out that the Christian right began being willing to push the corporate rights agenda without there necessarily being a Christian element to it in order that the entire agenda gets pushed. That would mean that if we're dealing with abortion rights, you can't necessarily talk at the same time about the war in Iraq.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, it's very important to notice how they did what they did. Bush campaigned as a centrist. He talked about how he cared about the rights of, you know, gay people, and how he cared about the rights of women, and how he cared about, and he chose, you know, Colin Powell for his, quote, diversity, and he chose Condoleezza Rice for her diversity, even though she's a former Texaco executive, which is pretty much where her heart lies. And he was very smart in campaigning as a centrist, and then the first day of office, he showed himself as a Christian right-winger in his anti-abortion stance and many other stances. I think we have to be smart and copy our enemy.
It seems to me that if we were going to pinpoint one element in the United States, we'd have to pinpoint the role of the media in mm-hmm. all of this. Because I think if you're going to mount a movement, you need to get the word out, and you can't get the word out on individualized websites.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to come through the mass media. How do we do that when the mass media is whoring against us?
The mass media is owned by fewer and fewer conglomerates. Those conglomerates absolutely have a political position. Their political position is less regulation. The Republicans are giving them that. When you go back and you look at these media conglomerates, they have been paying off the Republicans, you know, and giving them huge campaign contributions, and it's paid off for them. Look at what happened with the FCC. We needed more deregulation. Are you kidding?
Okay, Erica Jong, you can write a book or you can speak out. Are you going to get heard? Can you become a pundit?
It's harder and harder to get heard. And in fact, I've been noticing that since 9/11, what we have on TV are white men from the 50s. More and more and more. I mean, I'm not only speaking about Cheney and Bush and Wolfowitz and people like that, but even the people who are getting on TV and mouthing off are stupid white men. Increasingly, it's as if the feminist revolution never happened. And that's very dismaying to me. But there is something very good going on, which is if you look at the way the protest against the Iraq war bubbled up before we even went to war, it happened much faster than against the Vietnam War. And the reason for that was the Internet. And when you think of organizations like Move On, which I support, and other organizations, and you see the power of the Internet to organize people, that's a new factor. Now, the FCC is probably trying to take that away from us, too, even as we speak, and to censor the Internet. And the Patriot Act is trying to take it away from us and other things. But there is still one channel of communication that is not yet censored, and that's the Internet.
But the Internet is so diffuse. And that's, I think they did a survey that showed that, you know, sure, there are these millions of sites, but people always go to the same ones.
Right.
To me, the other side of it is that a friend of mine in Hawaii was going, well, how do I get information? I said, hey, get online and read the New York Times. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't have done that 15 years ago. You can do it now.
And you can get very specialized information. I mean, you can go to the Debka site to listen to what's going on in the Middle East. You can go to TomPaine.com. You can go. I get Slate magazine every morning, which gives you a roundup of the papers all over the world. And then you can go to those newspapers. That's, I think, very useful. I mean, I think Slate is probably the greatest magazine that the Internet has produced. And even though Michael Kinsley is no longer the editor, it seems to carry on his tradition.
Erica Jong, changing the subject, moving it into a completely different direction, you had a novel called Fanny. Someone's doing a musical production of it now?
We are. It's not yet mounted. We have been developing it as a musical for 15 years.
And
we're now developing it at the Manhattan Theater Club in New York.
And the Manhattan Theater Club actually has put on several musicals, so this is moving in the right direction.
We are moving in the right direction. All we need is $5 million.
Who's doing the music and lyrics?
The music is done by Lucy Simon, and the lyrics by Susan Birkenhead.
Lucy Simon did Secret Garden, and Birkenhead has done several.
Jelly's Last Jam. She is a brilliant lyricist. So we've been working on this for quite some time. And now we've come to the point where we just need major money.
Erica Jong, what about films? Now, Fear of Flying was a film a long time ago,
wasn't it?
It was never made into a film?
It's owned by Columbia Pictures. Every few years, somebody pops up and says, let's do it! And it's not in my power to do that. You know, it's owned by Columbia. But listen, all you brilliant young directors and producers and actors out there, when you get the clout, you can go to Columbia and make it. And I'll help you.
Well, one thing good, even as this retrenchment of feminism in entertainment comes along, there are still outlets like HBO and Showtime putting on good materials with strong women.
Absolutely.
Erica Jong, in looking at having written Fear of Flying, which opened the door to, I guess, feminist sexuality, because I think prior to that people did not perceive feminism and sexuality quite as strongly. Moving ahead 30 years, did Fear of Flying, do you think, push things in a more open direction, or was there reaction to it? Now that you're looking back on it, what do you see the influence of your own work on, say, the zeitgeist?
I think it opened the door for women to write books about their inner feelings. I think it also changed the way men write books. I don't think you would have the novels of John Irving without Fear of Flying. Male novelists exploring women's heads and minds. It became interesting because of Fear of Flying. So I think it had a liberating effect on American fiction in general. And the book has been read all over the world and continues to be read in Polish and Serbo-Croat and Chinese. And what astonishes me is how much people identify with it and how much the sexual politics are the same all over the world, which leads me to believe that we could have really a great grassroots movement that would be international if we only knew how to collaborate and make it happen. I think it has had a liberating effect on literature and on culture. And I'm proud, you know, that I wrote it.
At the time, did you have any conception when you were writing it? Did you know it would get published? Were you afraid it wouldn't get published because it was so out there?
I never thought it would be published.
Really?
I thought it would be just that it was this cri de coeur that I would have to put in a desk drawer and that I would never find a publisher for it. But I had to write it. Then when I turned it in to Holt, then my publisher, they thought of it as a literary first novel. And they were going to print very, very few copies. And then along came Elaine Koster, who was the editor-in-chief of New American Library, a paperback firm. And for the first time, there were women who were editors-in-chief. And she said, this book is the story of my life. And she compelled the hardcover publisher to print a bigger printing. She invested money in advertising. And it's really because of her that the book reached the wide audience it did.
What happens? This is something Harper Lee wrote, To Kill a Mockingbird, and after that she could never write again. What was your feeling afterward? How do you top this? Can you top this? What goes through the mind of somebody who creates a work, I hate to use the word seminal, given the context.
Feminal
work.
Right.
What goes through your mind? I mean, now 30 years later, you're Erica Chong, you've written several books, you could write whatever you want. You've gone past that. But at that particular time, how did you keep yourself going?
I kept myself going by going back to poetry, which is where I started. Thank God I did that. Thank God somewhere, because it was very discombobulating to be suddenly famous. I came out of Columbia Graduate School, where I was studying for a PhD in 18th century English literature, and suddenly I was the Erica Jongs of this world, who are leading women to moral decay and decrepitude. It was unbelievable to me.
Right.
I was totally discombobulated by it. But I think the way I survived it was that I went back and wrote poetry again, and that was my center. And poetry is not read by a wide audience, but I never stopped writing it. I haven't stopped to this day. So that was a way of sort of reclaiming my center. And then it was very hard. You know, the second novel, as Henry Miller said, is a revolt in the desert. Everybody has shivs out for you when you publish the second novel. I published How to Save Your Own Life, which I think is a very good novel, and around the world has been a bestseller, and people just attacked me viciously. Mario Puzo said to me a long time ago in Malibu, when I lived in Malibu, he said, why bother to write a second novel? They're all going to attack you. Why not just write movie scripts and make lots of money, like I'm doing? And I said, Mario, if I don't write the second novel, I can't write the third novel. And if I don't write the third novel, I can't write the fourth novel. And if I don't write the fourth novel, I can't write the fifth novel, and so on. And he said, you're really crazy, he said, because they'll never forgive you for the success of this book. And he was then writing the movie script for The Towering Inferno and making, you know, $500,000 per script and writing crap because he had been poor for so long. And he had this huge Italian family to take care of. He felt that he wanted to take care of them now that he had the ability to make those deals. And I honor him for that, actually. I think he's a great guy, late guy, but he was a lovely guy. But I had a different idea of the writer's life. And my idea was that I wanted to be Colette. And when I was 80 years old, I wanted to have a shelf of books with my name on them. And I had a sort of European idea of the writer's life. In a way, that saved me, that I had this rather effete European idea of the writer's life, that I was just going to go on and on and on, and I have.
And you've written historical novels, which is a completely different world than Fear of Flying.
Right. I love writing the historical novel because it's such a way. I mean, the historical novel, like the futuristic novel, is a way of satirizing the present. I've always wanted to write a dystopia, by the way, like Peggy Atwood's Oryx and Crake or The Handmaid's Tale. I've never really done it because I see the danger in the dystopia. The danger in the dystopia is that all your characters will be soapboxes, and that's a problem. But maybe someday I will do it.
But can't that also be a problem, say, I mean, it's not one in Sappho's Leap, but you can see where it could be a problem.
Absolutely, it could be. And you want the psychological motivation to motivate the characters rather than your intellectual agenda. You know, D.H. Lawrence said, not listen to the ideas of your characters, but to their low calling cries as they wander in the dark woods of their destiny. You want to write about people's hearts. You don't want to write about their intellectual agendas. Because novels that only have intellectual agendas turn out to be very, very, very ephemeral.
There's a writer who I once interviewed who's not exactly a leftist, a man named Joe Gores, mm-hmm. who once said, and I pardon the phrase, but he said, you can't be honest if you're being politically correct as a novelist.
I think that's true, actually. I mean, I think that political correctness has no place in fiction and poetry. It has a place in polemic, and I'm a great believer in polemic, and I write polemical essays about things that I really believe in, and I think that's important. I love to be a polemicist, but I try, maybe without much success, to keep it out of my fiction because I feel that it pollutes fiction.
In that regard, what happens if, as you're writing, the characters, characters never really get take on lives of their own, but they do need to maintain consistency as mm-hmm. you're writing them, so that to that degree they do take on lives of their own.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if a character does move in a direction that disturbs you? Do you go with it anyway?
I know that when I was writing about Praxinoa and Aesop, you know, Aesop was a real historical character, but nobody knows
right.
what he was like. My Aesop is a black man, which is one possibility, because there were Ethiopians in Greece. And the Greeks had this nasty habit of taking other nations prisoner and making their victims into slaves. But often these slaves distinguished themselves and became free. And Aesop, we believe, was one of those. You know,
I think the example could be, and maybe it's intrinsic to the story, of what eventually happens to Sappho's and Aesop's relationship. You know, it didn't necessarily have to go to that place, or did it?
Well, Sappho and Aesop are very, very good friends, and then they make the mistake of going to bed.
That's what I
and
mean.
And it just wrecks everything.
Was that intended, or did that just, again, come out?
I think I knew, you know, that Sappho is in love with Alcaeus, and he's her true love throughout the book. He and Praxinoa. She has a male love and a female love throughout the book. But she loves Aesop in a different way. He's her friend, and he's in love with her sexually. And at one point she falters and falls into bed with him on a boat. Not bed, deck. She falls into deck with him. He adores her, and she can't love him in that way. And so it's a complete disaster for both of them. And Alcaeus finds them, and it's a complete disaster for him all the way around because it promotes this jealousy which he can't deal with. I guess what I wanted to write about there was how peculiar and Byzantine sexuality is, and how it invades our lives in such unexpected ways.
Two quick questions, Erica Jong. When you see something like Sex in the City, does it dawn on you that without you, there wouldn't be something like Sex in the City?
Absolutely. You know, I see that and I say, wow, now you can do it on television. When they tried to take an ad for Fear of Flying on television, they wouldn't accept the ad for the book, for the paperback. So we've come a long way, or have we? I see sex being used pornographically on TV. In other words, by pornographically, I mean in order to sell products to women. I don't see a celebration of pleasure. I don't see a celebration of female pleasure. I see young women, 14, 15-year-olds, giving boys blowjobs to be popular. I don't see them being pleasured. So I think that, yeah, we've had a sexual revolution, or have we?
Well, I just keep thinking back to Norma Shearer in The Divorcee in 1934 or 33, having sex for the pleasure of it. That ended with the code. And now we look 70 years later. We see it again, but only on one TV show. Maybe that's
well,
it.
You see it in certain foreign films. You never see it in American films. Never. You see it in films by Pedro Almodovar and people like that. You see pleasure being celebrated, but never by American filmmakers. American filmmakers, for the most part, celebrate death. And sex usually ends with some horrible catastrophe. Think about, for example, our big woman's picture of the year, The Hours. Look at the way the women end. Virginia Woolf commits suicide, has a sexless marriage, and then commits suicide. I'm not speaking of the performances, which were great performances.
Right.
Julianne Moore wants to commit suicide, but doesn't, instead abandons her family and goes away. And Meryl Streep's character, who is a gay woman, spends her whole life caretaking a gay man, who then commits suicide in front of her, breaking her heart. What have we advanced to among women? All those women are masochists of a sort, and yet it's thought of as the great women's picture of the year. It is the apotheosis of masochism, of female masochism. It's horrifying in a way. And here are these three brilliant actresses playing these masochistic roles. So what has changed? I say nothing.
Erica Chong, you've written Sappho's Leap. Have you started work on another book?
Yes, I'm going back to a contemporary novel I put aside when I began Sappho's Leap. And it's a contemporary novel about a woman of a certain age caught between her dying parents and the next generation. And it's very much set in today, and it will have a lot of satire in it. And I hope it will have a lot of sex in it, because people haven't stopped having sex.
You've been listening to an interview with Erica Jong, whose latest book is Sappho's Leap, also coming out the 30th anniversary edition of Fear of Flying. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.